Happy holidays, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to The Crime Scene. Just wanted to make a quick note because a lot of you had asked about it, and I've tried to get the word out on social media, but I know not everybody is a denizen of the Facebook or the Twitter or the Google Plus, for that matter. So I wanted to let you know my book is now available on the Kindle store. So it's available in Kindle, Nook, and in paperback. And as of December 18th, you may actually still have time to get it. Certainly, the electronic versions of Kindle and Nook, the beauty of that is you can truly wait to the last minute and get it delivered instantaneously. So we thank you so much for that. Just wanted to give you a word and let you know about that. And now on to The Crime Scene. Have a happy holiday season, everybody.
The crimes, the criminals, why did they do it? Who got hurt? Did they meet justice or commit the perfect crime? You'll find all the clues at Jim Harold's Crime Scene.
Welcome to The Crime Scene. I'm Jim Harold. So glad to be with you once again. Really excited about today's show because this idea of Victorian crime fighting has always fascinated me. Going, of course, back to Sherlock Holmes and... very timely, there's a new Sherlock Holmes movie out with Robert Downey Jr., Sherlock Holmes 2. So I'm very excited to talk to our guest, Chris Payne. He is the author of a book called The Chieftain, Victorian True Crime Through the Eyes of a Scotland Yard Detective. And I'll tell you a little bit about Chris because he has a fascinating background. Actually, his background has been in virus research. Very accomplished, even so much so that he achieved an OBE, the Order of the British Empire, for his services to horticultural science in 1997. He was a chief executive of Horticulture Research International. He had been very involved. He had been working at the University of Otago, New Zealand, and then eventually moved on to the Unit of Invertebrate Virology at Oxford, and later moving to the Glasshouse Crops Research Institute, Littlehampton. So an extremely accomplished first career and a second career as a writer. And this latest book is about a long-lost family member going way back who was known as the Chieftain at Scotland Yard. Chris Payne, thank you for coming on The Crime Scene today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So, first of all, how do you go from, and first of all, my applause in doing it, how do you go from a career in research, as you did, to becoming an author of multiple books?
It's easier than you'd expect, because research has been at the heart of my life, whether it be scientific or now historic. So, if you're a scientist and you're a researcher, you can get interested in plenty of things. And but sitting in libraries or working in laboratories is the right sort of thing to do, whether you're a scientist or a historian.
Well, and we've had other people on who have had similar paths. They've been known for one thing, and then they become authors and actually been very accomplished at it. So, again, it's such an interesting thing to me, and I've experienced, and I'm, in my 40s, but I've experienced this as well. The idea of having one career these days is almost passé. You're going to have a range of things that you do throughout your life. So that's fascinating to me. Well, tell us about who the Chieftain was. And how did you discover him in your family tree?
I'll start with the second part, if I may. I was doing some research on my grandfather, who died at the end of the First World War. And I have correspondence from him from the trenches on the Western Front. And I realized that I'd have to find out a bit more about my family history. To understand all the references to the people that he mentioned in his letters. So I spent a year or so working on my family tree, and in the process unearthed the fact that his grandfather had been a detective at Scotland Yard, and thinking called George Clark. And not thinking too much about it, I thought, well, I'll Google Inspector George Clark. And it opened a complete can of worms, because the first thing I found, the first hit, was to a site which showed that George Clark had been on trial at the Old Bailey for corruption, a case that he was acquitted for, acquitted of, a charge he was acquitted of, but he went on to have to retire at that stage. So I thought, wow, shock, horror. But I wondered what he was like before he got to the dock of the Old Bailey. And that really is what the book is about. It's about his career as a policeman, as a detective at Scotland Yard.
Before we get specifically into his career, I'm sure you did a lot of research on Scotland Yard itself and being in law enforcement in the 1800s. And certainly, while modern law enforcement has its own unique challenges, and I would never make light of them, it had to be really challenging to fight crime back then because these detectives did not have a lot of the modern tools that we have today, DNA, and things even much more rudimentary than that. What was it like to be a Victorian era crime fighter, as it were?
I think you basically had to be very organized and assemble what evidence you were able to find very patiently. And so I think the overall mechanics are probably, in a sense, little changed. But as you rightly point out, the tools available to you were quite different because even blood typing wasn't available then. In fact, in one of Clark's cases, there's a reference to the fact that blood was found on the suspected murderer's clothing, but they couldn't tell whether it was human blood or animal blood in those days. So it was the evidence assembled was often more of a more circumstantial nature. And to be sure that you had a convincing case, you had to assemble a number of pieces of these circumstantial evidence before you could persuade a jury to convict or otherwise.
And that brings up a point, and you may or may not have researched this. What were conviction rates like back then? Was it more difficult to get a conviction?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I've not looked too hard at the sort of conviction rates as a percentage. In Clark's case, I would guess that he probably, at least on the cases I've been able to unearth and investigate in some detail, his conviction rate was probably around 75%, something of that order.
That sounds pretty good to me, although I don't know either. I don't know what the standard is, but that sounds awfully good. And in doing this, what were maybe some of them? We'll get into George Clark's background, but what were some of the things that you thought were maybe you didn't realize about the era and time of crime fighting? And I've got to realize that a lot of this is probably gleaned from reading newspaper articles and those things. So there's certain things you're never going to be able to get at. But what were maybe some of the things that surprised you? Maybe some of the fallacies that we think about that era when it comes to law enforcement and things like the Scotland Yard, who's been depicted in so many movies and books. What did you find?
I expected it to be a lot more parochial than it turned out to be. In Clark's, less parochial than it turned out to be. And the reason for that is, soon discovered that he was working internationally. If cases needed to be, needed the evidence, needed to the arrest, if appropriate, he would travel. He traveled America. He was frequently in Germany. He was in France. He was in Austria. That surprised me because, let's face it, at that time, there were only 9 or 10 detectives at Scotland Yard, and yet they were traveling not just around the country in the UK, but also overseas to catch their man, get their evidence. And that, I think, more than anything else, did surprise me. Because we have to remember that when he made his first arrest of a murderer, it was in New York Harbor, and it was in the days before telegraphy was available.
Right. That's amazing to me to think before telegrams were available. And we'll get to Clark in a second. What and did you see anything? You know, when you see, for example, the recent revival of the Sherlock Holmes franchise, as it were, those kind of things. Do you see things in popular entertainment that you just found to be totally wrong?
Oh, well, I think we have to remember that Sherlock Holmes, however much we enjoy him, and I enjoy him as much as any, was a fictional character. You know, the flights of fancy and wonderful descriptions of finding criminals, I think was is fanciful, very enjoyable. But at the end of the day, I think that the Holmes pictures don't convey the grind and the routine and the long hours and the extensive surveillance activities that had to take place. I think most of the crimes were eventually solved by hard graft rather than flashes of inspiration.
Kind of old-fashioned grit. Absolutely. And hard work.
Absolutely.
So George Clark, let's talk about him. How did he get started in the London Metropolitan Police Force?
Not entirely sure of the details, but he was brought up in a sort of a country area about 20, 30 miles north of London. And his whole family had been agricultural labourers, although intriguingly, at least three of his uncles had received various convictions, including transportation convictions for various felonies in their time. But he was one of 10 children. Agriculture was in pretty poor shape in those days. You couldn't make a lot of money out of it. And so he moved into London. I believe he may have worked as a groom, possibly for one of the brothers of the Duke of Wellington of the Battle of Waterloo fame. Mm-hmm. But I haven't been able to provide the absolutely final convincing evidence that would convince me that that was the case. But basically, there wasn't much money to be made on the land, so he and later some of his brothers moved in to become policemen. And they were very enthusiastic. It was a new police force at that time, and they wanted good, fit, strong men, and agricultural laborers fitted that category.
Now, in some of the documentation on your website at chrispaynebooks.com, and we'll be sure to give that again before the end of the program, you mentioned that Clark was considered a slow starter, maybe a late bloomer. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes, well, firstly, he joined in 1840. The detective force at Scotland Yard was set up in 1842 with only 9 or 10 eight detectives at that particular time, actually. He spent over 20 years, 22 years, as a policeman. He didn't get promoted from police constable to sergeant until 13 years into the force, which was, I suppose, par for the course, but not a spectacular rise. And sadly, one of the few things that I've not been able to find out is what triggered his transfer to Scotland Yard. So basically, he was one of the foot soldiers of the police force for quite a long period of time, which I think actually gave him good sort of basic contact with the criminal fraternity. Because he'd have seen them on the streets.
He understood them at the street level and knew their mind. So when he was elevated, he could still relate back to that wealth of experience.
Absolutely.
One thing that I'm curious about, because we always know, of course, there's the legend of Jack the Ripper that occurred later on and different famous crimes. But in general, I think most of us have the idea, particularly the Victorian age. It's a genteel age. Maybe things were a little bit kinder back then than they are in the present day. And I'm sure that you ran across a lot of crimes. Were people nicer back then, or are we just fooling ourselves?
Oh, absolutely fooling yourselves, I think. Let's take the first sort of murderer that he arrested, which was the murder of a guy who was killed in the first railway murder in Britain. and he had to go to America to actually make the arrest. Well, when he brought the murderer back, public hanging was still taking place in London at that time, and the hanging after the conviction of this German murderer called Franz Müller brought in 50,000 people off the streets to sort of watch the ceremony, if you like. Meanwhile, in the crowd, there was a great deal of criminal activity going on, with various activities like garrotting and bonneting, as they used to call it, knocking the top hats down over people's heads and then rifling their pockets and heaven knows what. So I think, by comparison, we seem pretty civilized some of the time.
And I'd never heard of that before. That's fascinating to me, that using the top hat for criminal advantage. Now, what kind of crimes? Was it the same kind of mix we see today? What did you, petty larceny, or was he more on the murder side in terms of his investigations, Clark, that is? What did you find about the mix of crimes going on at that time and the ones that he was involved in?
It was quite a mix. As I say, the detective force at Scotland Yard was very small. During his career, it never got much above about 30. In total detectives to cover all sorts of detection of crime. So a wide-ranging activity. At the top end, it would be murder. At the bottom end, it would be things like burglary, sometimes associated with murder in one particular case. He also became known, and it became his poison chalice, if you like, towards the end. He became well known for breaking up gangs of illegal betting men, and he was allocated that particular task by the Home Office, and worked at that quite hard over a period of 5 or 6 years, and it ultimately contributed to his the reason why he ended up in the dock at the Old Bailey himself.
And let's get into that a little bit, because it sounds like some of his achievements were lost in the annals of time due to this corruption charge. What were the circumstances involving that?
Quite intriguing. In 1976, a very intelligent betting scam was established by two rogues called Harry Benson and William Kerr, who had accomplices as well. And it took some while for the police force to realize what was going on. Clark was busy with other cases at the time, and although he had worked a lot on betting prosecutions, he wasn't given that case to investigate. Another detective called Nathaniel Gruskovich was given charge of that inquiry. Anyway, to cut a long story short, during the process, it took a long time to catch the villains, and people started to suspect why the police inquiry appeared to have been so slow. And after the villains themselves had eventually been arrested and convicted for the fraud, there was an investigation into police corruption, which increasingly showed that three of Clark's colleagues could have been complicit in corruption. So in July 1977, those three men and a bench solicitor were arrested, and Clark was actually one of the arresting officers.
Mm-hmm.
But when the case came to the magistrate's court in Bow Street, famous magistrate's court in Bow Street in London, and the two leading rogues, Benson and Kerr, were brought in as witnesses for the prosecution. They also implied that Clark had been involved, had received money from them, and so on. And although Clark denied these charges, there are indications that the most senior law officers at government level, our Attorney General and Solicitor General, were concerned. Well, they may well have suspected Clark as well by then, but they were certainly concerned that the case against the other three men, detectives, might be undermined if Clark was not also arrested and charged. So on September the 8th, 1877, Clark's friend and boss, Superintendent Williamson, arrested Clark, and it's said that he had tears in his eyes as he did so, and Clark was actually put on the same charges as the other three detectives.
So he was charged due out of almost a political expediency to make everything look good as opposed to any real evidence?
That's one way of reading it. If you actually look at the detail of the papers, the documents in our National Archives, there is a clear there's correspondence between the senior lawyers and the Home Office, which suggests that may have been one reason. Now, I'm not saying that they might not also have started to have their own concerns about Clark's involvement in the corruption as well. But certainly there are aspects of the correspondence that point quite clearly that if Clark wasn't arrested, then they were worried that their case against the other three men might be undermined. The reason I say that is because if Clark had been left unarrested, he would have been able to give evidence for the defense. Mm-hmm. Once he was arrested, he no longer had that opportunity, because people who were arrested and charged in those days were not able to give statements in their own defense.
So how did it play out? How did this trial play out in terms of... Was that big public sensation?
It was huge.
How did it go?
It was the sensation of the year, undoubtedly. Initially, Clark faced the magistrate's hearing and was then along with the other three officers, sent for trial at the Old Bailey. And the start of the trial, October 20th, 1877, I think it was, and it wasn't completed until November the 20th. It was the longest trial that had been held at the Old Bailey by the time they reached their verdict. And it was the social and news sensation of the year. You know, in those days, elegant women would turn up at court using it as, sightseeing and entertainment. They wanted to be seen there. The streets were blocked outside men were brought in from prison. Clark had got bail, but the other three men brought in from prison in Black Mariah's. The crowds would hiss at them and cheer as the fraudsters were brought in to give their evidence statement. So when the verdict was reached on November the 20th, I don't think there was a newspaper in England that didn't have some comment on the case.
So, at the end of the day, what happened?
At the end of the day, Clark was acquitted, but he was the only one who was acquitted. The three detectives, the three colleagues, were sentenced to 2 years hard labor, and the dodgy solicitor received the same sentences as well. But essentially, the issue finished Clark's career. He was reinstated by the Commissioner of Police at the Metropolitan Police, at which point the Home Office and the Home Secretary got very exercised and said he can have his pension, but he must retire. So about 5-6 weeks after his acquittal, he was retired. By that stage, he's probably quite glad, because he was already 59 and 38 years in the police force, and he did have his pension at the end of it. But he never got his legal costs. He was never paid his legal costs by the Home Office. So that was how it ended.
Now, in terms of maybe his, other than this corruption, what would you say his most famous cases were? Which ones did, or even maybe the ones that you thought were the most exceptional?
Yes. Well, he was only a sergeant in 1864 when he arrested Franz Müller on a sailing ship in New York Harbor. That was, generally speaking, his inspector, Richard Tanner, gets the credit for for solving that particular case, and probably deserves a lot of the credit, but Clark was certainly a trustworthy officer. I think the cases that he was particularly associated with include something called the Tichborne Claimant case that occurred in the early 1870s, which was basically some guy who travelled back from Australia claiming that he was Sir Edward Tichborne, and he was back to claim his inheritance. It's written up in the book, but basically Clark was largely responsible for undermining the sort of evidence on the Tichborne claimant towards the end, and that I think was a very significant feather in his cap. Whether you liked it or not, he was very good at shutting down illegal betting operations, which probably didn't make him very happy with the betting fraudsters or yeah. with the average man in the street, to be honest. But he'd been given the job to do, and he was pretty good at that. He also eventually solved another murder where a guy had basically pushed his mother off a mountain in Austria. The Austrians had originally let this guy off, but Clark had come across this gentleman before, the murderer, and carried out further investigations, persuaded the Austrian authorities to relook into the case, and the guy was then convicted of his wife's murder. And he probably also murdered his mother-in-law in Cheshire a few years before that. So that's something of the flavor of Clark's cases.
So as a family member, albeit somewhat removed through the generations, does it give you some satisfaction, or do you feel in some way that you have rehabilitated his reputation after maybe it being unfairly tarnished by this whole corruption trial?
Well, I think the book right at the end, I leave a little bit of question mark in my own mind. Ultimately, I'm very happy for readers to look at the book and come to their own conclusions. The jury at the time decided that Clark was at least innocent of the charges against him. My satisfaction, I think, is in fleshing out the man and his contribution to crime detection in Victorian Britain, because I think what is really true is that Clark is only ever known at the moment, apart from my book, in books or in memories, as the Scotland Yard detective who was acquitted but may well have been guilty. What I've done is really flesh out his career and say, well, actually, here's a man who worked as a detective for Scotland Yard for 15 years and really made a huge contribution to crime prevention and detection in those days. In fact, he ended his career as second in charge of the detective department. So you can't change history. I just thought it was a great story. I couldn't believe that I've been so lucky. It didn't, you can't change history. It doesn't matter to me whether he was innocent or guilty. But I've given a bigger picture, if you like, of his career. And I've enjoyed researching and writing it hugely.
Now you have, you are planning on a second book. Is it also involve Clark?
Only indirectly, in the sense that my second book is targeting the First World War. It had always been my intention to use my grandfather's letters from the First World War trenches as a basis for a book about that particular period. And I got diverted by discovering George Clark, if you like. Now I'm returning my attention to where I had originally meant to be, and that's on the First World War, where I think I have a different story to tell, but hopefully as appealing in its way.
And let's be clear, this is not your second book overall. You've authored about 90 scientific publications, but kind of new within this more historic tack.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, even now, I wouldn't surprise me if the jury is out on, you know, on the book. I've written it. I did wonder about trying originally a more novelistic approach, but I'm a trained scientist. I'm used to assimilating, assembling, presenting fact, and that's essentially what I'm probably best at.
And I don't mean to interrupt you, but that does bring about a parallel. And we'll just going back to Clark for a moment, the parallels between an investigator and a scientist. I would think that you found quite a few.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, it occurred to me that if I'm genetically predisposed to investigate things, I think I might know now where it came from.
That's great. That's great. Well, where can people find out more about you, more about your books? Because certainly we want them to check this book out and your upcoming military history program. And if they're into science, certainly you have a very detailed scientific publications. But where can they go on the net?
Right. Well, a good start, I would say, would be my website, which is all one Chris Payne Books, all one word, .com. So that's chrispaynebooks.com. That will be a start. The books are the book about Clark Chieftain is already published by a UK publisher, but it is available overseas, and it's already available through Amazon.com, Amazon.co.uk, and other. It's in good booksellers, all good booksellers available. Either through order or maybe in the stores in the UK as well. So there's no excuse for missing it, basically.
There you go. Well, luckily we have listeners from every part of the world, and we certainly have a strong UK contingent. So, and also it's available at Amazon.com, and we'll have links to that as well. Well, we thank you so much for joining us today on The Crime Scene.
Jim, thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
And thank you for listening. Happy holidays to everybody. If you get to listen to this before Christmas or New Year or whatever your celebration of choice is, we thank you so much for all you do and for tuning in to programs like this, The Crime Scene. We'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.